You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers back to the second part of a two-part series on the Apalachin Convention. If you remember last week, we learned how to pronounce Apalachin. It's not Appalachian, it's Apalachin. I'm here with my good friend. You can hear her chuckling in the background, Kate Kozel. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
All right. It's good to have you back.
And thank you.
We shall move along with the Apalachin meeting. And tonight, we're going to talk about the man who discovered this meeting. And you know, it wasn't an FBI agent. It was a local copper. Actually, it was a state trooper. Sergeant Edgar Crosswell. He was a detective sergeant with the New York State Police. Worked in a barracks. They call them barracks up there in the Northeast. Did you ever notice that?
No, I didn't know Pennsylvania
that. And the State Patrol, their office, they call it the barracks.
We call it the barn.
Call it the barn. The State Patrol, they call it the barn here.
Well, local police, we used to call it going back to the barn.
Oh, yeah, we did, didn't we?
Going back to the barn.
Well, they call it the barracks back east. I noticed I went to an LEIU convention in New York and Pennsylvania and Harrisburg, and they called their offices the barracks. I guess back in the day, they maybe slept there like the military is more like the
Could
military.
Could be, yeah.
You don't sleep in the barn here, do you?
No, we don't sleep in the barn. Maybe it's the Midwest, and that's why we call it the barn. Not quite sure.
We used to say hit the bricks, too. I wonder if they say hit the bricks. Do they still say hit the bricks?
We used to say hit the bricks,
right.
Yeah.
I think that's because all the streets were made of bricks at one time.
And then, you know, as I was an FTO, some of the younger officers mean, do you mean asphalt? So, there you go.
You mean asphalt. Give me a break. Edgar Crosswell had a little problem with this local resident named Joseph Barbara. He did a extensive background check on him, even had some of the detectives at Albany at the State Patrol headquarters do some background checking, and he found out that this guy was an organized crime guy out of the northeastern part of Pennsylvania. Now, Sergeant Crosswell worked out of Binghamton, New York, and Joseph Barbara had an estate in this area. A few of the things that Sergeant Crosswell learned. Joe Barbara was a suspect in a 1931 murder in Wyoming, Pennsylvania. A few months later, Pennsylvania police found a Thompson submachine gun in Joseph Barbara's car, and they linked it to a gangland shooting in New York City. In 1933, Barbara was arrested again for a double murder that was linked to some kind of mafia activities. 1933 later, he was a suspect in a brutal torture murder of a Scranton, Pennsylvania bootlegger named Albert Wichner. He learned that in the 1940s, Barbara had built this 11-room home with five outbuildings on 53 acres of land out by Binghamton. Barbara had formed a small group of mobsters from the Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania area, and they established a legitimate business bottling soft drinks in the area. They must have made their own soda pop. It didn't say that it was like a franchise for, I couldn't find out what the name of the soda pop was. And you guys out there know what kind of soda pop that was. That would be an interesting little tidbit, wouldn't it?
That would be very interesting.
When you play the mob trivia game and say, well,
what kind of
soda pop did Joseph Barbara of Apalachin, New York make?
Hopefully it was a strawberry soda.
Strawberry soda. Sergeant Crosswell found out that he had some pretty good political connections in Albany, the capital of New York, and he'd got a beer distribution license for the area. And he also got a franchise from the Canada Dry Company to bottle and distribute their products. So he was doing pretty well for a guy that was doing murders back in the 30s during the bootlegging days. And what does that tell you?
That he made the right choice.
He made some right choices, didn't he? Knowing all this background would end up with Sergeant Crosswell taking some action. His actions would lead to mob bosses from all over the United States fleeing through upstate New York woods wearing expensive suits and alligator shoes.
That would have been a sight to see.
That would have been a sight to see, wouldn't it? Our own boss, Nick Savella, was one of them. On November 13, 1957, there was a motel in the area, and they called the state police substation where Sergeant Crosswell worked and made a complaint about someone passing a bad check at the hotel. I guess in the 50s, you might write a check for a hotel room.
Sure.
Now, if you You know, I can remember when I was a kid, you know, you'd write a check for everything.
Yeah, you sure would.
I guess credit cards took over for that check writing thing. Now everybody mm-hmm. has a debit card, don't they?
Right, right.
Which is like writing a check, only it's instantaneous.
Right, exactly.
His partner, Trooper Vincent Bancisco, and he drove to the motel late that afternoon to check out this bad check complaint. While they were in there talking to the owner's wife, Helen Schroeder, Sergeant Crosswell noticed a cocky young man whom he knew. This was Joseph Barbara Jr. He pulled up in his Cadillac. The sergeant and the trooper ducked back into a small lounge off the office area as Jr. Barbara entered the motel office. They heard him book 3 double rooms for 2 nights. He mentioned that his father was hosting a meeting of folks who were involved in the soft drink industry, but he refused to tell the manager the names of who the guests were or when they were arriving. He paid a deposit and left. Sergeant Crosswell knew something was fishy. Wouldn't you think something was fishy? Here's this mob guy booking
rooms. I sure
would.
And what a coincidence that they just happen to be there for one thing and end up with that information.
Really, that's how it happens.
That is how it happens.
That's exactly how it happens. You're lollygagging along, just screwing around, and all of a sudden you'll see something. It's like, oh, that's interesting. Let me take a little closer look at that. This didn't
look
right.
The whole point of taking that and saying you see something else and let me take a closer look.
Yeah, just let me take a look at that. Let me get back and just watch for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That works. I was going down Troost once. I saw a car, a guy named Michael Cattu. I knew he was a cocaine dealer. He's a white dude, used to be a fireman. And I knew he was in the higher end of cocaine, but we really didn't know much else about him.
Right.
It's 41st, 42nd Troost. There's a convenience store there, and this guy was parked across the street. His car was just sitting there, and I thought, well, that's weird.
Yep.
Why would his car sit there? So I just pull in the convenience store and sit there a few minutes, and out of nowhere, I see this black dude who, I don't know if you ever watched The Wire, but he looked like Avon Barksdale. He was like a 30-something black dude, nicely dressed. Would be dressed like, you know, like I would.
Right.
Had on a pair of slacks and a nice shirt, pressed and clean and everything, walking kind of up from about a block off of Troost, off of Forest. And then there was another one that came down Troost, looked just like him.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another guy that came up into the parking lot and saw me and then walked up where I was just kind of standing in front, and I turned and got on the phone. So he stood about 8 feet from me, like he was kind of waiting on the phone, but just killing time while these other two guys just halt and just one on each corner of 41st and Troost and just wait. And so I get on the phone, I call back in the office, and I said, just talk. Just talk to whoever answered, the secretary, and just talk to me. So we talk and talking, like, I, you know, finally I can't talk anymore. And I hang up, and these guys are just standing there.
Yeah.
Like, well, la-di-da-di-da. I get my car and leave, and I go up, and I go back around the block, and when I come back, everybody's gone.
Gone, yeah.
Everybody's gone.
Yep.
I know they were meet there to get get several kilos. I bet I should have just jumped on that car, called a district car, and towed it, and said, let's look in the trunk.
Yeah, and I bet you would have been right.
I bet I would have found some cocaine, but... So that's that's kind of how it works. You're just bumbling along, and all of a sudden, if you're paying attention. You'll run into something. So Crosswell, the next day, he knows there's going to be this meeting, and his antenna's up. He starts driving around. He goes to the bottling plants. It's closed. There's no cars on the lot at all. They drive out to Barbara's estate, and there they see 4 automobiles. Not a big deal. So they go away, and they come back later on, actually the next day, November the 14th, 1957, and what they see is about 100 men at Barbara's 53-acre estate. He thought maybe he was involved in some kind of bootlegging. I mean, you know, I don't know what kind of bootlegging you had done in 1957. I guess you still could avoid the tax stamps, booze in from Canada or something. Mm-hmm. Hadn't paid the tax stamps or something on it. He calls some U.S. Treasury agents in, Arthur Rustin and Kenneth Brown. And they're coming down from Binghamton. It's about 30 minutes away. And they come down, and he calls his boss, Crosswell does, calls his boss up in Albany, and it gets... I guess he has to ask permission to set up a surveillance on this date, which he does. And Crosswell and his partner, Vincent Bancisco, and the two Treasury agents drive up a road. McFall Road was the name of it. You guys are traveling up into this area. It's McFall Road, where the estate was located. As they get closer, they said they would report later they smelled a strong odor of meat cooking over a open flame. That's what I say in the neighborhood. I go out the back door and I smell and I say, somebody's searing flesh outside. You smell that, haven't you?
Yes.
As they get closer, they see there's the whole big area in front of the Barbara's multi-car garage is filled with parked cars, expensive cars, Cadillacs, Imperials, Lincolns, and Chryslers. Mm-hmm. Maybe not people in the soft drink business. If they were, they were owners of soft drink bottling companies. There were so many cars parked in front of the garages that they made an adjoining pasture into an overflow lot. So the officers parked their car, probably out on the road, got out, walked back up across the pasture, and just started writing down license plate numbers. I've done that a few times.
Oh, yeah.
A small group of men from the barbecue pit area walked away, and they kind of drifted out towards this field, and they saw the officers bending over with little pencils and pads writing down license numbers. Said they were stunned, and they started yelling at the guys, hey, you know, you get out of here. But as they weren't running toward them, they ran back to the house to tell everybody else, you know, the cops are here, and yelling, you better get out of here.
Yeah, that's an eerie feeling.
When you get caught.
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing here?
Nothing like knowing there was one of two of you, and there's probably 100 in the house ready to come on out.
I was at a funeral of Michael Cattu. That's a small world. Michael Cattu gets killed shortly after this or within the next year. I have his funeral up north of the river, and I'm driving around writing down license numbers in the parking lot. And I see this one mob guy's car, Jimmy Duarte's car there. And that's kind of a sign right there.
Oh, yeah.
What's he doing here? Because he didn't really fit otherwise. Mm-hmm. But he was there. I go back up across the street in a vacant area. It was way north, and it was up on 169. They hadn't really put any houses around this funeral home yet. Mm-hmm. And there was a great big cemetery right behind it. So I park up in this lot, this area that's been cleared, getting ready to develop. And all of a sudden, about three cars come flying out of that lot.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there. I'm kind of trapped in a way. I mean, I didn't know what else to do, and I didn't really know if they were coming up for me or whatever. They came right dead into me.
Yeah.
I'm flying up. They jump out of the car, and they come running up the car. Well, I've got a gun, and I just, pull it up, and I just hold it below the window.
You sure do. That's exactly what you do.
And I went ahead and rolled the window down. I said, can I help you? And he said, what are you doing here? And at the look at him, see, this guy had been a fireman, and they look like firemen. These were some of his buddies from the fire department. He was all involved in, he had bought an old antique fire truck, and they were fixing it up.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he's doing with his dope money.
Right.
He had a body shop, too. And they were, so we had these buddies from that. They were probably knew he was a criminal of some kind, just the way he got hit. I mean, he definitely was a hit when he got killed. But they finally, you know, I said, hey, I'm police, and reaching with the other hand, kept the gun going.
Yeah, you gotta, yep.
Got my badge. Yeah, I said, you know, I'm a cop. Oh, okay, all right. I said, you know, I just look and see who was going, you know, we're working on the murder. Oh, okay, all right, officer, sorry. He said, we didn't know who you were. We didn't know, you know, he'd been murdered, so we didn't know who you were.
Right.
I said, okay, see y'all later.
Everyone saves face, and yes. There you go.
Scared the shit out of me.
Oh, yeah.
I was cool, but.
Yeah.
Got to be cool.
You got to be. You have a little peace of mind when you have that gun that's going to go right through the door into somebody.
Well, if somebody reaches in,
well,
it's
you
just
know.
A little crack of the wrist up.
And yep. And then,
then we'll see what happens.
Exactly.
You know, what do you do? Crosswell backs off to public property because he doesn't sure what, you know, you don't know what grounds you're on
here.
You don't really, you don't have a warrant. You don't have anything but your suspicion.
Right.
He's already called back to the substation and asked for backup. And about that time, 20 or so state trooper cars come flying up. They're driving their old Plymouth cruisers. They got their red lights and their sirens on, and they are ready to go.
Yeah.
So backup's there.
Yep.
Backup has arrived. Help has arrived. They all just storm the house. They just all park and drive up the driveway and get out and surround the house. And people come flying out of that house. Luckily, Sergeant Crosswell had detailed several of them to set up roadblocks. So if somebody mm-hmm. did drive out past them, they could then get them stopped and they couldn't get on by. So they're trying to catch, these guys are running out through the woods. They're jumping in their cars. They're filling the cars and taking off. And the very first car that hit a roadblock was a little truck driven by a guy named Bartolo Guccia. He claimed to be a fish salesman from Endicott, New York. He said he'd just been making a delivery and waved him through, figuring he was really a spectator. But they did write down his name. Turns out they checked his name later on. At this point in law enforcement investigation of mafia, the only people that are really keeping accurate records about mafia were the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. So they check this guy's name through afterwards and find out he has an arrest record, extensive arrest record dating back to 1916 for about everything, including murder. Mm-hmm. And he's obviously a narcotics suspect. They stop the next car. They get the driver and passenger out. Sergeant Crosswell does this himself. He finds out it's Russell Bufalino, who is the boss of the Northeastern Pennsylvania crime family. And with him is a New York crime boss, Vito Genovese, who is, you know, goes on to really be much more famous over the next few years. Sitting in the back were three more mob guys. They all claimed they were just dropping by to visit a friend. He wasn't feeling very good. Joe wasn't feeling very good, and they just thought they'd stop by and see him.
I often go running from people's houses that I go to visit.
It's often like 100 people. When you're sick, do 100 people come over, and if the cops come around, they all go running?
No, I just had shoulder surgery, and
nobody came over, did they?
Right.
Matter of fact, you're kind of mad about that. Or is everybody?
Exactly. My dogs can only do so much.
Yeah, really. Well, if you'd thrown a bunch of steaks on the grill, maybe some of them would come over.
That's true.
I mean, I'm a vegetarian, so you'd have to throw some vegetables on the grill.
I'd do that for you, Gary.
Crosswell realized this was getting out of hand. He had to make some tactical decisions. You imagine, you're the sergeant, and you've been a sergeant.
Yes.
You're a sergeant, and you've got all these troopers that are loaded for bear and ready to go, and you've got this fluid situation.
Mm-hmm.
You got people running out the back. You got people getting in cars, people milling around. You know, what do you do?
Yeah, at that point, you have to make a decision. What, are you going to gather information? Are you trying to whatever so that you can tactically come out of that okay? Or you have people running around doing all sorts of stuff, and that's when it gets out of hand.
Yeah, really. First thing he did, and you know, I'd like to think I would have the wherewithal to do that, and I'd like to think you would too, but sometimes we lose our head and blame others.
Never.
And you know, the poem is, if I can I can keep my head while all about me are losing theirs and blaming me mm-hmm. for it, then I'll be successful. So he was successful, and he kept his head. He organized his troopers into small groups of like almost like arrest teams
mm-hmm.
and had them go confront people and control them in some manner. And so they had to go out through the woods, and they had some people going out in their cars. The troopers send them out in the countryside, driving the back roads around there, catching mm-hmm. these guys coming out of the woods and then putting them in their cars and arrest them. And
sounds like he came up with a good plan really quick.
He did. And because it was talk about ongoing fluid mm-hmm. situation. He had to move fast. There was a huge number of cars that were trying to drive out and were stopped at the roadblock. Sergeant Crosswell then ordered all them to stay in their cars, and he created like a convoy, and he put state trooper cars in front of them, behind mm-hmm. them, and then they escorted them to the state troopers building, which was not that far away, a few miles away, but they escorted all them, mm-hmm. picked up the others that had been running out through the woods, and got everybody, as many as he could catch. Now, like, they didn't catch Nick Sabella, he and Joe Filardo, either they hadn't got there or they got away on foot, but they did find them at a nearby train station. They were reported they were sitting there all nonchalant, like they were just waiting for a train. In the end, they found 60 men altogether and put them in this little police station. And back then, everybody was smoking. It's reported that the air was blue with cigarette smoke. Can't even imagine what that'd be like.
Ugh.
Be like a bingo hall. You guys ever been to a bingo hall when you could still smoke in a bingo hall? Oh, my God. But you know, when I first came on the police department, I'd look around at roll call, and I would be almost the only one not smoking.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, and everyone smoked in police cars.
Everybody in police cars everywhere. They were sitting on all the chairs and floors and desks and whispering and talking to each other and trying to get some kind of a story together. And then Crosswell ordered them one by one to come into his office for interrogation. Made them eat a little cheese, as we used to say.
Yeah.
We did that to a bunch of Klan guys that we picked up one night down here. We kind of had the same situation. They were recording a TV show for the public TV channel. It was a big deal at the time. And we were all around the outside, and they had a guard out in front, and we had a tax squad working with us. So we had the tax squad take off that. These two guys were just patrolling the perimeter, and they had a couple guns in that truck. And they were in walkie-talkie communication with the rest of these Klan guys who were inside at the studio recording this TV show that they were going to put on the public access channel. And when they couldn't get hold of their perimeter security, they panicked. And they when they left, they'd parked about four blocks away. And when they left, they all took off running. There's about eight of them. They took off running.
Wow.
And they split up. So there's 10 or 11 TAC guys. There's two squads, and Sergeant or Captain Nunn was in charge of them. And we told Nunn, said, they're running. And he said, he ordered his guys, just go grab them. Grab everyone you can. They grabbed them all up, and we got back to Nunn since he was outranked me. I was a sergeant. He was a captain. I said, what do you think, Captain? He said, just take them to headquarters. And so we took them all to headquarters and interviewed them one by one, made them eat a little cheese.
Yeah.
They did not like that. We got about eight guns, I think, that night.
Oh, that's always good.
Yeah, really. You always are relieved when you can find guns like that. Because we had no charges on them, nothing.
We had
nothing.
Right.
Totally, you know, it was like we were basically kidnapping them, taking them downtown and towing their cars, too.
Yeah, in a way.
They were wrong, you know.
They were wrong.
They were wrong. When you're wrong, you're wrong.
No matter how few admit it.
So every man that they could identify there, those 60 men, when they checked into them, they were some kind of a professional criminal and some connected to some major La Cosa Nostra crime organization from whatever city they came from, whether it was Kansas City or Pennsylvania, Buffalo, New York. Magdaleno was there, I'm pretty sure. I can't remember who was there from Chicago. All the five families in New York, New Jersey, I think Santo Traficante from Tampa was there. So they were all there. Sergeant Crosswell noticed this is kind of an interesting little tidbit here. There was an unusual number of blood relatives there. There were four pairs of brothers. There were two sets of cousins. There was a various mixture of uncles, nephews, and in-laws. So that's, all these guys are in the soft drink business. Or all of them knew this same guy, and they were all relatives. And they're from all over the United States. Go figure that one. There was one kind of interesting guy they found there, and he got egg all over his face. There was a guy named John Montana. I wonder if it's any kin to Joe Montana.
Probably, I don't know.
Probably not. I don't know. Maybe he's a...
Could be.
Could be an uncle, a great uncle of Joe Montana. John Montana, he was a businessman from Buffalo, and he was really influential in state politics. He's a city council member, and he'd recently been nominated as Businessman of the Year by the Erie Club. He owned the biggest taxi cab business in Buffalo, New York, but as they checked into him, they found out he was what would be called a capo, or a crew leader in the Buffalo Mafia family run by Stefano Magadino. One of the state troopers had found him out wandering through the woods. That guy really wanted to get away bad because he knew this. He has much or more to hide than anybody. They found him wandering in the woods around the Barbara property. He claimed he'd been driving from Buffalo to New York on business, and the brakes on his car quit working. Well, he just happened to know Joe Barbara, and he thought he'd just stop in his friend's house, and then they go get a mechanic to look at his car, and he was just having a quiet cup of tea with Joe's wife when all of a sudden these cops came running around. He said, here's another good one. He said, Well, I thought I'd just take a little walk in the woods until the commotion died down.
Right.
And that's where they found me. I don't know.
That's as good as when somebody runs a red light. And like, did you have any reason for doing that? And like, well, nobody else was using it.
There we go. You ever run red lights late at night when there's nobody else around? Just bash
sure
onto
do.
It? Okay, thank you. I thought I was the only one that did that. I think my second wife, she's getting madder than hell at me for doing that. I thought I was abusing my privilege of being a policeman.
I've been told that the way I speed.
Yeah, have you been told that?
Yeah.
People don't like that when you abuse your power. Oh, no. Well. We're just human beings, aren't we?
We are.
Well, Mr. Montana, he never really lived down that disgrace and was pretty much out in New York State politics and in the city of Erie, Pennsylvania. And I don't think was ever voted in to be the Businessman of the Year by the Erie Club after that. Some of the other interesting stories that came out of this, there was a guy named Vincent Rayo from Manhattan. He was a mob guy, and he said he thought he'd been invited to a buffet luncheon. He didn't really know who was having it or anything else about it, but he was there because he'd been invited to this buffet. Carmine Lombardozzi, who was a hoodlum out of Brooklyn, said he was there to go hunting. But when he asked why he didn't have a gun or like a hunting vest or a warm hat or boots, he said, well, I was just going to buy it when I got here.
Mm-hmm.
There was a capo in the Magadino organization from Buffalo, Jimmy LaDuca. He'd been apprehended in the woods, and he said he was chasing a deer.
You know, there's sometimes people have told me the truth, and they say, you're going to let me go. I have over 20 warrants, and my license is suspended, and I have a little weed in my console. And,
yeah.
And I said, I'm so happy you told me the truth. Well, you get your things taken care of and have a wonderful night.
You were a good cop, weren't you?
You bet.
Joe Filardo from Kansas City said he was just a businessman. Didn't really. He said he just happened to be there. Most of them said they were paying a sick call on Mr. Barber, and they just all happened to get there at the same time. Another guy named James Ostico said he had come to the house to fix a pump. I don't know what kind of pump it was. They had a grand jury, and They got some intelligence by the time they had the grand jury, and he gave the explanation as really why that meeting had been called. There's going to be a trial for a man named Lombardozzo, who we just mentioned, that had the he said that he was up there to go hunting, and he had been skimming from a jukebox operation that was owned by his mob family. There was other sources that claimed there was going to be a trial for Lombardozzo, but it was because he had raped some woman that was some family member. That was from a New York City police lieutenant, Thomas Mooney. I think Mr. Mooney was on the take. He was mm-hmm. trying to help him out. Croswell did not have a search warrant, but he never entered the house. So he
That's
thought,
true.
You know, you're really supposed to have a search warrant to search on the grounds, too. But I think you can enter on the grounds.
If you have a legal right to be there.
You got some reason to be there. I mean,
if he believes some kind of criminal activity is afoot and that he needs to further investigate, I would suppose he could be doing some further investigation.
You know, just walking up to the house, that's all they were doing. Yep. All these people were running out, so what do? You better check. I mean, somebody could be injured.
Right, and all those license plates there are in plain view.
Yeah. It was reported later that Tommy Lucchese from Lucchese family and Carmine Galante, Stefano Magadino of the Buffalo crime family, Sam Giancana from Chicago crime family, these were all bosses in their crime families. And they were there, but they never did find them. Sergeant Croswell would report later that these guys were never indignant. They always answered all the questions politely. And they left the station quietly, no fuss and no bother, which was the way it was with those mm-hmm. upper echelon mob guys. They don't get in your face. I was serving a search warrant on Tuffy DeLuna's house. It was the underboss. And his wife started getting all indignant about us in there serving the search warrant. And he just said, yeah, Sandy, he said, just calm down. He said, why don't you make these officers a pot of coffee? We're going to be here for a while. you got to admire and respect a guy like that.
Mm-hmm.
You still got to put him in jail when it comes time.
Right.
But
you're doing your job.
But you don't treat him like dirt, do you?
Correct.
Croswell was swamped by reporters at the station. Somehow the word got out, and the next day the headlines were all across the United States. A lot of reporters would say here was the Kefauver Commission, which had gone around the United States having hearings, calling in mob guys from local mob. We had one in Kansas City in like 1951, I think, called in all the heads of the mob in Kansas City and asked them about gambling and made them kind of at least admit they had connections with each other and confronted them with some of that kind of evidence. And so a lot of these reporters would say, you know, here's proof of what Estes Kefauver had warned the whole country about. There is a mafia and they are connected, a criminal syndicate, and they're connected throughout the whole United States, which, you know, at that point in time, J. Edgar Hoover was not really, he was more after communists than he was after
right,
the mafia.
Yes.
He didn't really, you know, it's kind of a, it's not really fair to him to say he didn't protect the mafia. He just had, he put his resources somewhere else,
yes.
I would say. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was really paying a lot of attention to him because they'd done so much heroin importation during the 30s and 40s
right.
and up into the 50s. And that supposedly is another reason that this meeting was held, was because they wanted to talk about whether the mob, anybody in the mob, should be allowed to deal in heroin, because it was... There was so much bad publicity by this point
right.
in time about being a heroin dealer. They didn't ever stop it. They slowed it down quite a little bit. And in Kansas City, they definitely, the mob boss, Nick Civella here, definitely did not directly allow people to deal in narcotics of any kind. Now, before, I think it was after he's dead, his own kids were got caught dealing in narcotics. Not his kids, but his nephews would be his... great nephews were caught dealing narcotics, and they had a guy, Junior Bradley, that was investing money into a local black cocaine dealer, one of our kingpins, really, and he was investing a whole bunch of cash money into this guy to help him do his cocaine business. In fact, he got caught trying to hire a hitman for the guy who was in jail, and his wife was going to testify against him. And it came out that he had tried to hire a hitman to hit this guy's wife to keep her from testifying. When she testified, she said she had seen grocery bags full of cash transferred between Junior Bradley and one of this guy's Jerry and Terry Kelton. They were twin brothers, Jerry and Terry Kelton's underling. Terry was running it out of the penitentiary. Jerry had been on the streets. I think he'd just gone back. So, you know, they did it, but indirectly back east, like this Carmine Galante was there. He became known as the heroin kingpin, and he had this connection with the Montreal mafia. We were talking about bad blood and that Montreal mafia. He made his connections with the Montreal mafia. I did a podcast on the French Connection, the real story behind the French Connection movie.
Interesting.
And that was all about this connection through Montreal. Back to Marseille and the Sicilian mob and the Corsican mob and on back to Turkey, where that's where the heroin originally
right.
came from, the Mideast, kind of that pipeline came through Cuba before, and then it moved up to Montreal. In that podcast I didn't really deal with that Rizzuto family, Rizzuto family.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Rizzuto family. I didn't really deal with that at all. I need to go back and do that. I'm trying to find.
It sounds interesting.
Yeah, I'm trying to find an expert on that now. That way I don't have to read and learn so much about it. Although I do like learning about it, but it's
right.
a little bit easier to find you an expert that already knows everything. Some of the headlines were Royal Clam Bake for Underworld Cooled by Police. That's a pretty colorful headline.
Yeah,
they used to have those. Police ponder New York mob meeting. All claim they are visiting a sick friend. Croswell had many critics, mainly because they were on private property. It was really questionable what they did.
Right, yeah. There's a fine line.
There was a fine line, especially taking them in custody, making them go down to the station.
Yes. I agree with you.
But, you know, it is what it is. You know, you got to do what you got to do, as we used to say. Later in the year, 1957, organized crime continued to stay in the news. They had killed there was a huge hit. Albert Anastasia was killed in that barber chair, and they had images of him laying
yes.
in a pool of blood around the barber chair. That was all I even remember when I was a kid. So They were really getting a lot of publicity, you know, all that. Then on top of this Appalachian Convention, out in the country like that. It wasn't just some kind of a city thing. Here these guys are out in the country. People begin to say, you know, there is some kind of a malignant, shall we say, criminal conspiracy throughout the whole United States that they work together, they conspire together. And in each local jurisdiction, I think a lot of people knew it because they had so many corrupt politicians. And we had them here in Kansas City, even up into the 50s and 60s. We had the last judge, Romano, he took they caught him from a drug dealer in like 1980, mm-hmm. I don't know, something.
Yes.
86, 87, maybe, yes. Taking a whole garbage bag, a garbage bag. I think a paper bag of grocery bag full of cash from Gilbert Dowdy, who was a fire captain, but he had a huge cocaine deal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, he was kind of the last of the real, you know, connected politicians and judges in Kansas City. I think they all pretty well gone now, maybe except in Chicago and New York. People demanded to know about this second government. Which now is no longer invisible. It's kind of a shadow government. It was like a shadow government out of the 30s and 40s and 50s. They started putting pressure on their local state and their own state police and their local police departments and the FBI. And then they had the McClellan Commission and started investigating organized crime throughout the United States. The New York State Legislature had a committee formed to do that. Formed the Joint Legislative Committee on Government Operations, and they served subpoenas on 34 of these Appalachian delegates. Had Sergeant Croswell come and an agent of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics to take information. And the reporting on this spellbound the entire United States, especially this guy from the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, because he had the intelligence going all the way back. He said there had been other mob meetings like this. There had been one in Cleveland in 1928. These crime families met again in 1946 in the now famous Havana Conference. Florida in 1952 and 53, one in Chicago in 1954. There had been one back up here at Binghamton the year before. And now this one. Quite a few of the people that were there, really well-known names, sworn in to give testimony, and they all took the fifth. the famous, I choose not to speak on the grounds that may tend to incriminate me.
Yes.
Right? There was a Lucchese family drug kingpin named John Ormento. I never heard of him. Joe Profaci, he had his own family, the Profaci family in Brooklyn. Antonio Magadino, who was a brother to the mafia boss, the Buffalo mafia boss, Stefano. There's a whole list of men who the Federal Bureau of Narcotics had connected up with various mob families from across the United States. They issued a report, and I'll just read the first sentence. The Appalachian meeting of November 14, 1957 is strong evidence that there exists in this country today an active organization or association of criminals whose operations are nationwide and international. Joseph Barbara, who truly was plagued by health problems, but I don't think they all came there because he was their sick friend, he never testified. They did take away his pistol permit. I guess he had a pistol permit and his beer license. He wouldn't even need a permit today.
Nope. You sure don't.
Soon after that, he sold that property and moved away. He died of a heart attack in 1959. Said only four of his concerned visitors from that meeting were found at his funeral. I assume they
interesting,
must,
yes.
Write down all the license plate numbers at his funeral. I've attended a few mob funerals and written down license numbers. It's kind of funny. It's like funerals and weddings. I mean, it's like part of this culture that they all go.
Mm-hmm.
And just like on The Godfather, I've seen it here in Kansas City. And The Godfather, you know, they all go to the funeral. They all went to the wedding of the Godfather's daughter. They make,
yes.
make little connections there and have meetings in the other rooms. And it's got a reason for them to be together. I don't know. I hate it when a stereotype lives out to be true.
There usually is some truth behind all stereotypes.
And that's true. That's true. So by 1959, in Manhattan, the feds in the U.S. District Court, they put together some kind of a racketeering conspiracy to obstruct justice by lying to the grand jury about why they came up to Apalachicola, and they actually ended up convicting them. It was kind of an ingeniously based prosecution, I would say.
That's one way to frame it, Gary.
I don't know how they conspiring to obstruct justice by lying to the grand jury about why they were at that meeting, but yet why did they know about the meeting and why were they?
Right, yes.
Needless to say, all those were overturned later on. Needless to say. But, you know, what's kind of interesting about this is really this sowed the seeds for later on the government, the legislature passed the RICO bill, Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Bill, which has been used immensely successfully ever since. It came into being, it says here, 1985, but it's really been...
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, you can convict people for racketeering, conspiracy to commit crimes, and then just have a few predicate crimes down there that anybody part of that group has committed. And if you get one storyteller in there that kind of ties it all together and a few wiretaps, you know, they're done. It's a tough one. It said that J. Edgar Hoover was embarrassed by this uncovering of this cabal of mobsters. And it made a mockery of his long-held position. There was really no criminal national crime syndicate in the United States. But that's when he set up the Top Hoodlum program. And that's when we got in Kansas City, and they started basically in Chicago was one of the big ones. And we got one right after that based on that program in Chicago and continues today.
So the sergeant that kind of spearheaded this and
Sergeant Crosswell.
Mm-hmm. What happened to him after all this? Because it sounds like some of his police work, good, bad, or however he's bent the rules, or at least he took the initiative. What happened to him in his career?
You know, he just continued on. He was kind of halfway or three quarters of the way through his career and continued on and retired and lived out his retirement. You know, that was kind of like the highlight of his career, shall we say.
Well, and what a highlight that was.
It was. You know, probably at the time, he didn't really realize what he'd done.
Mm-hmm.
Hindsight's always 20/20.
Yeah.
But I don't think he really realized what he's done. But yeah, he kind of like continued on and retired. And I don't know exactly, I don't know when he died. I did see something about that recently, but you know, there wasn't anything else about him. But it sure did affect the rest of the United States and how we approach these kinds of things. Kind of it also added to the romance of the mafia in every major city too, and see how powerful we are.
Yes.
You know, we work together. We're connected. You know, I'm in Kansas City, but. You know, I'm connected. If I'm part of the mob in Kansas City, I'm connected to New York, or I'm connected to Chicago, or
yes.
Vice versa. If you're in Detroit or St. Louis or whatever, you know, it just makes you a little more powerful, a little more important. So it's kind of a double-edged sword giving them publicity like that.
Yes, I agree. Kind of bigger than life.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the shall we say, the they depend on that. They depend on that being seen as larger than life, larger than the law, bigger than anything to intimidate people, intimidate businessmen, and get their way. For example, the myth is like our mob boss can go to this guy in Las Vegas who owns these casinos and sit down and say, here's what I think you should do. Well, this guy knows that he is the underboss of the Kansas City mob because people that work for him in these casinos would have told him that's who you're meeting. And he's meeting him at a mob lawyer's office Oscar Goodman's a really well-known mob lawyer. So this guy represents mobsters. Now this casino owner had never met Tuffy DeLuna. He was just some guy from Kansas City. But he knew enough about his reputation from all these other people that when this guy sits down across the desk from me and says, in a nice, quiet, calm voice. I've talked to Tuffy. He's just a nice, quiet, calm voice. He's a guy that told his wife to go, you know, hey, Sandy, go fix the fix these officers some coffee. And he says, you know, I think you ought to sell that casino. And then he picks up a piece of paper and he reads off the guy's wife's name and his kids' names.
Right.
And doesn't have to say another word.
Right.
So that's, you know, they depend on that. That's really how it works for them, that intimidation factor, that they're bigger than life. They can do anything and get away with it.
Right. And that fear, and that fear, and the fear of keeping your family safe. And
yeah. And your business safe.
Yes.
You know, whatever. So, you know, what they say. And like, oh, we had another, I got a tape of this guy, Joey Lombardo. He is, he's trying to intimidate a guy from St. Louis named Morris Schenker. Morris Schenker has borrowed some money from the Teamsters Union and bought a casino. Well, he was supposed to kick a bunch of money back to a Chicago outfit guy named Alan Dorfman. I know this gets a little complicated, but a lot of you guys already know this story. He's supposed to kick back to Alan Dorfman. Well, Alan Dorfman's not, you know, he's not gone after him. But anything that Alan gets, the Chicago outfit gets a piece of it. We got a tape of Joey Lombardo on the phone talking to Schenker. He says, Morris, he said, Alan, he's not that kind of guy, but the people that are with him, they're that kind of guy. You know, you got to get this money. He said, shit or get off the pot. You know, you can get it. You got to get it. You know, Alan ain't that kind of guy, but he said, what can you do? He said, you can send one guy to jail, maybe me. Maybe you can send one guy to jail, but, you know, what are you going to do? You got to get that money. You know, you don't have to.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, that was even more of a direct threat than usually what they have to give or even want to give. You don't want to say those words directly and out loud. I'm going to kill you.
Right.
They ain't like TV.
Right, yeah.
And they depend on that mystique.
Mm-hmm.
Of I own, you know, the courts and the government and the politicians, and I've got connections all over the United States, and we can, you know, I do whatever I want, and you have to do what I say. Interesting. All right, so I think we've beat this into the bushes. Look for the Appalachian movie, but when this is released, that movie will be out all over the place, and you will be able to find the true story behind the Appalachian meeting from Gangland Wire. I appreciate it. If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, or if you have a friend who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Don't forget that I have a movie out there. You can download it. You can rent it for $1.99 on Amazon. Or even better, if you want to get the special features, you can go to my website and order it for, I think, $14.95 is what I put on that, I think. And I've got a book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. You can buy that off my website or buy it on Amazon. I would suggest you get the Kindle book because I used a bunch of the actual wiretap transcripts in the book. And you can, in the Kindle version, you can click on links in the wiretap transcripts and hear the actual audio of the men who were talking about skimming from Las Vegas casinos. And the Kansas City Mob Tour, you can get that from your iTunes store, your Apple store, and take a tour of Kansas City mob sites. So, Kate, it was good to have you here.
Thank you, Gary.
And we'll have to do this again.
I would love to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Talk to you guys later out there in Wiretapper Land.
Music provided by our good friend and superfan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.